Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Hello, this is William Sink for Eli James. Eli won't be here tonight. He'll be back tomorrow night with me on Yahweh's Covenant People. Tonight is Friday, August 27th, 2010. And it's hard to believe it. It seems like January 1st was just a few days ago, and 9 months of the year, eight months out of the year are gone already. It's passing quickly. Tonight I have Greg Howard here with me, and we're going to discuss Ezekiel chapters 25 through 27, and as Eli and I have been doing Ezekiel for several weeks now. Tonight will be an interesting section of Ezekiel because these chapters in Ezekiel, I believe, refute any possibility that Jews could be the Israelites of the Old Testament. And there's much historical intertwining we'll see here with Ezekiel. In the past few chapters of Ezekiel, we saw being portrayed that same pattern of sin and punishment, which is outlined over and again throughout the prophets, that the people are suffering the destruction of their society and are being taken into captivity because they suffered the immorality and evil which came to permeate their nation, just like we have it today. Yet a clear underlying theme is that Israel would be preserved and would be sifted and purged in this captivity and ultimately delivered and rebuilt, and a new covenant would be made. That was Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 37, and the new covenant promise in Ezekiel is also in chapters 34 and 37, verses 25 and 26, respectively. And that this would culminate the rebuilding and deliverance and salvation of Israel in a much greater result for the glory of Yahweh. Greg, hello. How are you doing?
Hi, Bill. Good to be here tonight.
I know sin and judgment are your favorite topic, so I thought I'd greet you at this point in my opening.
Well, studying Jews and understanding Jews is certainly one of my favorite topics. Judgment on Jews is way up there with me because I just see such degradation and oppression heaped upon our race, when in reality, you know, we're the ones that were meant to have dominion on this earth, and yet it's been stolen from us. So I think it's always good to dig into the history of that entire process, and you know, we're going to do that tonight in these three chapters, and it always helps our understanding to look at history, because it just explains more perfectly our current situation, because it essentially repeats itself.
Well, it has been stolen from us, but it's our own sin and our own weakness that allows that to happen. I mean,
certainly
it was stolen in deception, but it's our own weakness that allowed it.
Right. Yeah. That's well said. I mean, it's not that it was just stolen from us, but it's Yahweh's judgment that it was allowed to be stolen. So, you know, we see what went on in our past of our ancestors, and it makes our current situation more and more clear. You know, fortunately, it's really incredible to me that Yahweh is calling back his elect and opening up his word to us here. And that's just outstanding to be in this small group in this world that actually can see through all this Jewish fog and see what's going on. This is not many that are seeing it out there, you know.
Well, let me continue with my opening here. I'd like to,
okay.
A few verses I'd like to recap. Well, one was Ezekiel 22:15, and it says, "And I will scatter thee among the nations, and will disperse thee in the countries, and will consume thy filthiness out of thee." And I'd like to compare that to Amos 9:9, as I did last week. "I will sift the house of Israel among all nations." And that was done 2,700 years ago in Mesopotamia. "Like corn is sifted in a sieve, yet shall not the least grain fall upon the earth." And that shows that Israel was to be cleansed through the dispersion and then regathered. Ezekiel 22:26 says, "Her priests have violated my law," as we've just seen this homosexual male priest getting married in Britain to a young Negro, right? "And have profaned my holy things." What could be more profane than that going on today? They have put no difference between the holy and the profane, neither have they showed difference between the unclean and the clean. And we can compare Ezekiel 34:17 and find that that is speaking about people, not about things. And in Ezekiel 34 it says, "And as for you, O my flock, thus says Yahweh God, behold, I judge between cattle and cattle, between the rams and the he-goats." That's the future judgment. The sheep go to the right and the goats go to the left, right?
Yes.
Matthew 25 foretold 700 years before Christ told the parable in Matthew.
Yeah, what else could it be? I mean, obviously this massive judgment has not taken place yet.
And it's in our future. I think the priest, the Anglican priest and the young Nigerian man that he's marrying are both going to go into the lake of fire, and I can't wait to watch.
Oh, yeah, I don't see it working out any other way for those two. Well, the Negro, for sure. The other guy, I think he's as good as in there as well, just based on, the denunciation of homosexual behavior from start to finish in the scriptures. Don't see much hope there.
Well, we know them by their fruits. That they sneak into the priesthood, they pose as priests, and then they pretend that gay marriage is good.
Right, and then, just reap corruption upon, the true seekers that may be caught up in that church. I think you know my views on that whole concept of church and how that, to me, is just,
The church is anything. However, that priesthood represents an office before the eyes of the people. And the Jews sneak into every high office and perform all sorts of perversion from their positions of authority to set bad examples for our people, hoping that our people follow after them.
Absolutely. They're master infiltrators, they're just masters at infiltrating any and all positions of power, authority. Give them time, they'll end up owning it and controlling every aspect of it. The examples of that are countless.
Well, I think they have it now. I can't imagine where they're not. Well, where is Satan not sitting?
I don't know. It's hard to name anything. You look
well,
at what
organization is Satan not running?
None come to mind right off.
I don't think there is one.
Hopefully this show tonight is free of that influence. I like to think it is.
Right, I'm sure we'll have our troll or two. But would you like to pick it up with Ezekiel 25:1?
Yeah, let me skip ahead to that here. I went back into 22 to follow along with you here. How far do you want me to read in 25?
Well, I'll have some notes when we get up to around verse 5 or 6.
All right, just jump in whenever you want. I'll start reading. All right, we're in Ezekiel 25. The word of Yahweh came again unto me, saying, "Son of man, set thy face against the Ammonites, and prophesy against them, and say unto the Ammonites, Hear the word of the Adonai Yahweh. Thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, Because thou saidst, Aha, against my sanctuary, when it was profaned, and against the land of Israel, when it was desolate, and against the house of Judah, when they went into captivity. Behold, therefore I will deliver thee to the men of the east for a possession, and they shall set their palaces in thee, and make their dwellings in thee. They shall eat thy fruit, and they shall drink thy milk. And I will make Rabbah a stable for camels, and the Ammonites a couching place for flocks, and ye shall know that I am Yahweh. For thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, Because thou hast clapped thine hands and stamped with the feet and rejoiced in heart with all thy despite against the land of Israel, behold, therefore I will stretch out mine hand upon thee, and will deliver thee for a spoil to the heathen, and I will cut thee off from the people, and I will cause thee to perish out of the countries, I will destroy thee, and thou shalt know that I am Yahweh. Thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, Because that Moab and Seir do say, Behold, the house of Judah is like unto all the heathen. Therefore, behold, I will open the side of Moab from the cities, from his cities which are on his frontiers, the glory of the country, Beth-Jeminoth, Baal-Meon, and Kirathiam.
And this is important. It's important. You know, we read these prophecies, and we just read through them, and we automatically assume that all these people being spoken to are Ammonites, and all these people being spoken to are Moabites by race. And that's just not so. And people should actually, if they studied the names of these places, they would find that there's more here than we see on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, most of the Israelites have been deported, right? Well, there are cities of Israel that never were deported, and you just named three of them. Okay? If we investigate Beth-Jeshimoth, Baal-Meon, and Kiriathaim, and we see in Joshua 13:20 and Numbers 32, 37 through 38, that these were all cities of Reuben. And they're never mentioned as having been among the deportations of the Assyrians in 2 Kings chapters 15 through 18. Although the cities, these are Transjordanian cities in Moab, that they started calling themselves Moab. We see from the time of David and Ruth that these people were called Moabites because they were Israelites living in the land of Moab. And it's also very probable that at least many of these so-called Ammonites were actually Israelites dwelling in the land of Ammon. And there were probably some Canaanites and some Moabites and some Ammonites amongst them, just like there were Negroes in North Carolina today. That doesn't make all the people of North Carolina Negroes. Many of them are white.
That seems reasonable. That seems reasonable, what you're saying, certainly.
And here we have where it says that they were following the ways of the heathen, that they were calling themselves Ammonites by geography or Moabites by geography. And these cities are explicitly mentioned as cities of Reuben. And we have no reason anywhere in Scripture to imagine that anybody but Reuben was inhabiting these cities, or at least a majority of Reuben were inhabiting these cities today. And these people, as we've seen early in Israelite history, the Israelites turned against the Judahites and the people at Jerusalem. And we see that same contention carried on here. So we have Ruth is called a Moabitess, and she's an Israelite. Well, we have Naamah, the wife of Solomon, called an Ammonitess, and since she was the mother of the heir to the throne, she was probably an Israelite. These were geographical and not ethnic distinctions all throughout the kingdom period. They were geographical distinctions. They were not genealogical distinctions only.
Sure. That makes perfect sense.
All right. That's we're up to verse 10.
All right. Let's see. All right, verse 10. Unto the men of the east with the Ammonites, and will give them in possession, that the Ammonites may not be remembered among the nations, and I will execute judgments upon Moab, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. Thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, because that Edom hath dealt against the house of Judah by taking vengeance, and hath greatly offended and revenged himself upon them. Therefore, thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, I will also stretch out mine hand upon Edom, and will cut off man and beast from it, and I will make it desolate from Teman, and they of Dedan shall fall by the sword. And I will lay my vengeance.
We're going to see. Let me get into this. We're going to see Dedan mentioned later on. But
okay.
These Edomites, you know, according to scriptures, that this is actually talking about a vengeance that Edom deals against the house of Judah before it happens. In other words, Ezekiel is giving this prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem about a little over a year before it actually happened. And that could be timed from statements at the beginning of chapter 24.
All right.
All right. Now the according to the scriptures, Edom was allied with the Babylonians and actually helped tear down the temple and the walls of Jerusalem. And I have two quotations here to demonstrate that. The first is 1 Esdras in the Apocrypha. Yeah, you know, 1 Esdras in the Apocrypha is a much better copy of the book of Ezra than we find in the book of Ezra of the Masoretic text.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more complete, and it's much more in context with the time. And it's the Jews, the Masoretic Jews just hacked up Esdras and gave us Ezra, is what happened.
Yeah.
I'm going to quote 1 Esdras 4:45, which is happens to be missing from the Masoretic text, I believe. Thou also hast vowed to build up the temple which the Edomites burned when Judea was made desolate by the Babylonians, by the Chaldees. Now that's a legitimate verse, is proven at Psalm 137. And that was a psalm that was not written by David, and rather seems to have been written in the captivity. Here are verses 6 through 8. If I do not remember thee, yet let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy, remember, O Yahweh, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundation thereof. O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. So the Edomites were instrumental in actually raising or destroying the temple and walls of Jerusalem when the Babylonians invaded. The Edomites must have been in league with them and anxious to do this because they were a tributary nation.
Right. Yeah, yeah. With enthusiasm.
Yes, absolutely.
I've read that psalm before. Razz it, you know, it almost seems to hearken back to this verse here that I read. Because you have clapped thine hands and stamped with thine feet and rejoiced in heart with all thy despite against the land of Israel. I mean, these creatures are enthusiastically wreaking vengeance and judgment on us. They love it, you know. They love doing it. Nothing has changed.
And they're doing it today. They're tearing down our temples today, our bodies, one at a time.
Well, it's all, you know,
drugs and their pornography,
yeah,
and every other vile thing that they do in our society.
That's exactly right, Bill. And very little has changed. They, you know, now they not only do it with glee, but they make trillions of dollars by doing it. They've turned our destruction into a profitable business for them. You know, and again, the pharmaceutical industry, the one I came out of, is a perfect example. But there's many, many examples of how doing us harm brings them money. Such a satanic strategy that they've mastered over the years.
The entire medical industry.
Yeah, pretty much. And Yahweh only knows what it is that we're eating every day. Sometimes I don't even like to think about it. I just wonder what they put in the food, in the water.
Well, they've destroyed our food industry also.
Yeah, I know that.
Jewish business practices have destroyed our food industry. And then the Jewish government-run government forces us to subject our food to the Jewish-run pharmaceutical industry. And they profit three times from the destruction of our food supply.
They've got us every which way, and who among us realistically can grow all of our own food? I envy the small handful of people that have that ability.
Well, this talk now, I mean, Robert Balakai sent out a mailing this morning about eggs and an egg recall that was caused, the tainting of the eggs they believe was probably caused by vaccination of the chickens, and now they want, the FDA wants more control over the egg business in order to be able to save us from the tainted eggs that they caused.
Yeah.
They tainted. It's never ending.
And pretty much every...
Government's never been the answer to anything.
And the FDA is a classic organization that's riddled with juice top to bottom. We I had many dealings with them over the years, you know, mostly on an indirect basis, but was very familiar with their organization, who their structure of leadership was. Invariably, a Jew sits at the head of it. I'm sure a Jew is at the head of it now.
Well, tyrannical government with control over every aspect of our lives has never been good for mankind all throughout history, and has never been the assistant or support of mankind, ever. It's always only led to slavery and oppression.
Right, and maybe it's almost never been worse now, perhaps not so outwardly violent, but probably never more sinister than the current situation that we find ourselves in. As a race, you know, the country that our ancient ancestors founded now is literally being stolen, you know, one dark-skinned person at a time allowed to come in and take what is ours with government sanction. It's maddening to watch it.
Well, what was government assistance?
Well, yeah, with government assistance.
I mean, it's blatant. But I saw an article today also that the U.S. State Department, through a goodwill program, has built mosques at the expense of the U.S. taxpayer in 27 foreign countries. Now, I have to research this further, but if we can't have a cross on a White House lawn and we can't have Ten Commandments hanging from a courthouse wall because of the separation of church and state clause, which does not exist, which only exists in the minds of the Jews and the enemies of Christ.
Right.
And then our State Department can build mosques in 27 foreign countries, and that evidently doesn't violate their so-called separation of church and state clause, which does not exist. I guess because it doesn't exist unless you're standing on American soil.
That's really amazing.
I guess maybe that's what they meant by that.
And that article said that U.S. tax money was used for that?
Yes.
Wow.
It's being done through a State Department program, an outreach program. I have to investigate it further.
That's really amazing. Although nothing surprises me anymore. And to hear that, I think, wow, that's incredible. And then I think, well, I'm not surprised. You know, the only thing that would be surprising is if they built some churches around, you know, the country. Now, that would surprise me.
People should be outraged, but they won't be as long as Monday Night Football runs in September as scheduled. That's all they care about.
They won't be outraged at all. You know, they're fed such a steady diet of nonsense and, you know, Britney Spears and Lindsay Lohan and just keeping everybody hypnotized. It's really unbelievable to see through it. To see the programs as they go on to keep the white sheeple in the hypnotic state. It blows my mind to see it, you know, because it's so blatant when you see it and you understand it and you really see the you see through the Jewish smoke and fog and mirrors and you really see it, you know, the heart of them, who's behind it. It's right there in front of you if you look.
Well, we're on verse 14, and if you read that, we'll see what lays ahead for who's behind it.
All right, I like that.
But because this hasn't happened yet, except in part through the Romans of the first century, but that wasn't the complete vengeance against these people.
Certainly not. If it is, I'm very disappointed, because I have full plans to participate in that vengeance, I believe, and I think all of us will. I believe we're going to be quite busy that day. I believe Yahweh has plans for us to very much participate in the final vengeance upon these Edomites. Let me read there at 14. And I will lay my vengeance upon Edom by the hand of my people Israel. There it is. And they shall do in Edom according to mine anger and according to my fury, and they shall know my vengeance, saith the Adonai Yahweh. Praise Yahweh. What a great verse. Let me read that again, if that's okay. And I will lay my vengeance upon Edom by the hand of my people Israel. And they shall do in Edom according to mine anger and according to my fury. And they shall know my vengeance, saith the Adonai Yahweh. Thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, behold, the Philistines have dealt by revenge and have taken vengeance with a despiteful heart to destroy it for the old hatred. Therefore, thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, behold, I will stretch out mine hand upon the Philistines, and I will cut off the Cherethians and destroy the remnant of the seacoast, and I will execute great vengeance upon them with furious rebukes, and they shall know that I am Yahweh when I shall lay my vengeance upon them.
Okay, that's the judgment pronounced by Yahweh of all the countries and people, some of them Israel and some of them not.
Yeah.
Around Jerusalem, that's promised with the coming destruction of Jerusalem and thereafter. Well, we're going to get into Ezekiel chapter 26 and 27, and I have a long introduction to these two chapters I'd like to go through. It'll probably take about 15 minutes. That the it's important to understand the Tyrians. That Tyre was a very famous, preeminent city in the ancient world. It was the New York, London, and Paris of the ancient world, all rolled up in one. And they were famed for piracy, as we'll see here, and they were also Israelites, as we'll see here. And we'll see in the lament of – I'm going to read something that's not connected to Tyre, but it shows that if you understand how famous the ancient Phoenicians were for piracy, that the Greeks wrote about it all the time, that the poets wrote about it, it was The Tyrians were more famous for piracy than the Corinthians were for fornication, right?
Okay.
That's good. There's no doubt, and it's very often mentioned in the ancient poets. It's even mentioned in Herodotus. In fact, Herodotus actually blamed the start of the war of the Persians and the Greeks on the piracy of the Phoenicians and the kidnapping practices of the Phoenicians. So first let me read this section again from 1 Esdras, verses 20 through 27 in chapter 4. A man leaves his own father that brought him up and his own country and cleaves unto his wife. We see that's the law, right? He sticketh not to spend his life with his wife. And remembers neither father nor mother nor country. By this also you must know that women have dominion over you. He's really complaining about the man's letting a woman rule over him here.
Right.
Do you not labor and toil and give and bring all to the woman? Yeah. A man takes his sword and goes his way to rob and to steal, to sail upon the seas and upon the rivers. And looks upon a lion and goes into darkness. And when he is stolen, spoiled, and robbed, he brings it to his love, to his wife. Wherefore, a man loves his wife better than his father or mother. Yeah, many there may be that have run out of their wits for women and become servants for their sakes. Many also have perished and erred and sinned for women. But the women thing, the woman thing isn't really important here to my conversation. It's really that the man takes his sword and goes his way to rob and to steal, to sail upon the seas and upon the rivers. That's the behavior of the Phoenicians, which the Greeks constantly pointed out. And we've never seen the Jews do that. I mean, when a Jew wants to go steal, what's he bring? He brings a pen. He brings a ledger book. He doesn't bring a sword and sail the seven seas. It doesn't happen. Ezra's talking about the famous Phoenicians, and they are, the Phoenicians were Israel. And now I'm going to demonstrate that. I'm going to run through some points in my Phoenicians paper, because this is crucial to understanding Ezekiel chapters 26 and 27. And I wrote a paper, and it's on Christogenia. It's classical and biblical records identifying the Phoenicians. And here are some of the major points. Zebulun was prophesied to dwell on the coast. And he shall be, quote, a haven by a sea of he shall be a haven of ships and shall extend to Sidon. And that's the Septuagint translation of Genesis 49:13. While the territory in Israel proper, as we see it in the book of Joshua or Judges, allotted to Zebulun, does not border Sidon and it does not border the sea, Joshua chapter 19, verses 10 through 16. Isaiah 9:1 surely indicates that Zebulun fulfilled this prophecy. Dan is also found at sea, as the prophetess Deborah tells us in Judges 5:17, where she said also that Asher dwells on the seashore and the inlets of the coast, and Tyre, the ancient city, and Sidon, if we examine the book of Joshua, were both in the territory of Asher. And that's Joshua chapter 19, verses 24 through 31. That's the core territory of historical Phoenicia on any map. And Bible students, by following the Jews, doubt that the Asherites inhabited their own territory. And they're led to doubt that because the Jews have to mask the identity of the Phoenicians. If the Jews don't mask the identity of Phoenicians, the Jews can't be Israel. Bottom line. Now, there were Mycenaean tombs, which were found by archaeologists at Tel Dan in Palestine. And we see Dan also took to the sea, Judges 5:17. Now, Mycenae was the center of Greek culture before the Dorian invasions at the time of the Trojan War. The Dorians were also Israelites, and that's a separate topic. But Mycenae was destroyed in the Dorian invasions two or three generations after the Trojan War. Now archaeologists wonder about these Mycenaean tombs found at Tel Dan in Palestine, and scholars have been therefore led to imagine that the tribe of Dan were really Greeks. And the truth is that the Greeks were of several tribes, and one of them was Dan. Joshua chapters 11, 8, 13, 4, 13 verses 4 and 6, and 19 verses 28 and 29 all make it perfectly clear that the children of Israel were very active in and inhabited the so-called land of Phoenicia, encompassing Tyre and points north. And Judges chapters 1 and 3 show that the Israelites at this early period were dwelling among Canaanites, whom they failed to remove from the land, enslaving them instead. But when we look at the list of cities in Judges chapter 1 where the Canaanites were said to have remained, Tyre was not one of them. And Tyre soon after became the foremost quote-unquote Phoenician city, and the city out of which came all the Phoenician colonies of the west. It was indeed an Israelite city during this period. And I'll quote Strabo, quote, now, although the poets have referred more repeatedly to Sidon than to Tyre, and Homer does not even mention Tyre, and there's a good historical reason for that, yet the colony sent into Libya and Iberia, Carthage, and the Hebrew colonies of Spain, as far even as outside the pillars, meaning the Strait of Gibraltar, right? Him rather the praises of Tyre. In other words, all those colonies sang the praises of Tyre. They all claimed to be descended from the Tyrians, not from the Sidonians or any Canaanites. Now, actually, there were two cities called Tyre. There was an older mainland city, which in Assyrian records is called Ushu. And there was an island city a short distance off the coast. In the King James, Joshua 19:29 has a reference to the strong city Tyre. And the Septuagint has only, and the Tyrians, and lists that as a part of Asher's territory. The Septuagint, speaking of the inheritance of Naphtali, also gives that to the tribe of Naphtali at Joshua 19:35, where it says that Naphtali would inherit, quote-unquote, the walled cities of the Tyrians, along with Tyre itself. Now, while the land of Naphtali was not near the coast, these cities were listed in Naphtali's inheritance. Since there were two cities named Tyre, Paleo Tyre or Old Tyre, meaning the city on the mainland, and the island city, and they're not really distinguished anywhere in the Bible. Yet there may not be a conflict here, because there was the island and there was the walled city on the coast. And Isaiah 9:1 indicates also that Zebulun, along with Naphtali, along with Zebulun, was indeed what would be a sea-going tribe, and neither tribe had land on the sea. It may well be that Naphtali inherited or took for themselves the island Tyre, which is technically outside of Israel proper, by which reason it may also be that Tyre had its own king, who later controlled parts of the mainland. And there's actually one place in Scripture in 1 Kings chapter 9 where Solomon gave Hiram, the king of Tyre, a good portion of the mainland. It was described as 20 cities. And that's probably how Tyre came to control parts of the mainland, which were later known as, quote-unquote, Phoenicia. And that's strictly a Greek term, right?
Yes.
Josephus, the historian, talks about Hiram the artificer, who built most of the implements in the temple, right, for Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 7. And Josephus says that he was by birth of the tribe of Naphtali. We see in the Septuagint that Naphtali inherited one of parts of the cities of the Tyrians. And Josephus states that his mother was of the tribe of Naphtali, but his father was of Ur, of the stock of the Israelites, whose tribe was evidently not known to Josephus. And that's Antiquities, Book 8, Chapter 3, Paragraph 4. Yet here it is seen that there were people of Naphtali and Tyre, and later kings of Tyre also ruled Sidon, and that's in Book 8 of Antiquities, Chapter 13. And that, I would believe, surely helped fulfill Genesis 49:13. That Naphtali would dwell in a haven by the sea, and his border would extend to Sidon. The haven by the sea, Tyre, or Tyre, was actually called in Egyptian inscriptions Taru, the haven. When David had his census of Israel, much later, Tyre and Sidon were among the places where the census was conducted. And here, both of these cities, if we look at the account in 2 Samuel 24, 6 and 7, Tyre and Sidon are clearly distinguished from, quote, the cities of the Hivites and of the Canaanites. So therefore, Tyre and Sidon could not possibly have been cities of Hivites and Canaanites. They must have been Israelite cities. Now, I believe that Christ also attests that at Matthew 11, 21 and 22, and Luke 10, 13, where he states, "Woe unto thee, Chorazin, woe unto thee, Bethsaida, for if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes." Now, concerning the prophecies which forecasted the destruction of Israel and the Assyrian deportations, we find two mentions of Tyre, which are not in the King James Version or the Masoretic text, and both of them prove that Tyre was a city in Israel. And I really think that the Masoretes ditched these verses because they knew that they would eventually prove embarrassing. And those verses are at Amos 3:11, where the AV states, "An adversary shall there be round about the land." The Septuagint has a very less ambiguous, "O Tyre, thy land shall be made desolate round about thee." The reference to Tyre is entirely missing in EAV. Again, at Micah 7:12, the Septuagint reads, speaking to the children of Israel, "Thy cities shall be leveled and parted among the Assyrians. And thy strong city shall be parted from Tyre to the river," meaning the Jordan, "and from sea to sea and from mountain to mountain." So that clearly demonstrates that Tyre is an Israelite city. Now, surely Tyre was an Israelite city, and the historian Josephus also acknowledges as much in his book Against Appian, 1:22, where he quotes a Greek writer, Theophrastus, and his writings concerning the laws, meaning the laws of the Hebrews, which, quote, "the laws of the Tyrians forbid men to swear foreign oaths." And Josephus tells us that he was speaking of Israelites. And we see in the law of Yahweh that we're forbidden to swear foreign oaths. And then Josephus goes on to cite from Herodotus, from his histories, book 2, paragraph 104, and Herodotus stated that the Phoenicians and the Syrians of Palestine. Now, the Syrians of Palestine is what Herodotus called the Judeans, and that could be proven throughout Herodotus by examining book 2, paragraph 159, book 3, paragraph 5, and book 7, paragraph 89. Herodotus says that the Phoenicians and the Syrians of Palestine were circumcised. And Josephus points out bluntly that, quote, "there are no inhabitants of Palestine that are circumcised except the Judeans," meaning Israelites, "and therefore it must be his knowledge of them that enabled him to speak so much concerning them," meaning Herodotus. That the Tyrians had such laws and brought them to their colonies, it is evident in a statement of Strabo in his Geography at 3:16. Quote, "the Turdetanians are ranked as the wisest of the Iberians, and they make use of an alphabet, and they possess records of their ancient history, poems, and laws written in a verse that are 6,000 years old, as they assert." That has to be a reference to Scripture. There had to be some Tyrian somewhere in Turdetania in Iberia who had the Scripture. That's part of my proof that the Tyrians are absolutely Israelites. And even though Yahweh is scolding them here for their that their adversarial position that they took with Jerusalem, that's brother against brother, and we should be scolded for that. And that is why Yahweh, through the prophet, gives us a lamentation of Tyre in Ezekiel 27. Even though all these other places were scolded and were told that judgment was going to come down upon them, they were not lamented. Only Tyre is lamented.
Makes pretty good sense there, Bill.
Well, you could start with 26:1 if you would.
All right. Heading over there. All right. Ezekiel 26. "And it came to pass in the 11th hour, in the first day of the month."
In the 11th year. That 11th year, Ezekiel, all through Ezekiel, counts his years from the time that he went into captivity with King Jehoiachin, okay? He counts his right from the beginning, the year of captivity, from the time that Jehoiachin went into captivity to Babylon, okay? Along with 10,000 of the principal men and craftsmen of Jerusalem, and that happened circa 597 B.C. And we see that story in 2 Kings chapter 24, verses 11 to 17. So the 11th year would begin in 587 BC, which is actually about a year or maybe a little less, because we're in advanced in months here also. And that's about a year before the destruction of Jerusalem, which probably happened in 586 BC.
Right. Okay, let me read here. "And it came to pass in the 11th year, in the first day of the month, that the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, because that Tyrus hath said against Jerusalem, Aha, she is broken that was the gates of the people. She is turned unto me. I shall be replenished. Now she is laid waste. Therefore thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, Behold, I am against thee, O Tyrus, and will cause many nations to come up against thee, as the sea causes his waves to come up. And they shall destroy the walls of Tyrus, and break down her towers. I will also scrape her dust from her, and make her like the top of a rock. It shall be for a place for the spreading of nets in the midst of the sea, for I have spoken it, saith the Adonai Yahweh, and it shall become a spoil to the nations. And her daughters which are in the field shall be slain by the sword, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. For thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, Behold, I will bring upon Tyrus Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, a king of kings from the north, with horses and with chariots and with horsemen and companies and much people. He shall slay with the sword thy daughters in the field, and he shall make a fort against thee, and cast a mount against thee, and lift up the buckler against thee. He shall set engines of war against thy walls, and with his axes he shall break down thy towers. By reason of the abundance of his horses, their dust shall cover thee. Thy walls shall shake at the noise of the horsemen, and of the wheels, and of the chariots, when he shall enter into thy gates, as men enter into a city, wherein is made a breach. With the hoofs of his horses shall he tread down all thy streets. He shall slay thy people by the sword, and thy strong garrisons shall go down to the ground. And they shall make a spoil of thy riches, and make a prey of thy merchandise. And they shall break down thy walls, and destroy thy pleasant houses. And they shall lay thy stones, and thy timber, and thy dust, in the midst of the water. And I will cause the noise of thy songs to cease, the sound of thy harps shall be heard no more. And I will make thee like the top of a rock. Thou shalt be a place to spread nets upon. Thou shalt be built no more, for I, Yahweh, have spoken it, saith the Adonai Yahweh. Thus saith the Adonai Yahweh to Tyrus, Shall not the isles shake at the sound of thy fall? When the wounded cry, when the slaughter is made in the midst of thee, then all the princes of the sea shall come down from their thrones, and lay away their robes, and put off their broidered garments. They shall clothe themselves with trembling. They shall sit upon the ground, and shall tremble at every movement, and be astonished at thee. And they shall take up a lamentation for thee, and say to thee, How art thou destroyed? Thou wast inhabited of seafaring men, the renowned city, which was strong in the sea, she and her inhabitants, which caused their terror to be on all that haunt it. Now shall the isles tremble in the day of thy fall, yea, the isles that are in the sea shall be troubled at thy departure. For thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, When I shall make thee a desolate city, like the cities that are not inhabited, When I shall bring up the deep upon thee, and great waters shall cover thee, when I shall bring thee down with them that descend into the pit, with the people of old time, and shall set thee in the low parts of the earth, in places desolate of old, with them that go down to the pit, that thou be not inhabited, and I shall set glory in the land of the living. I will make thee a terror, and thou shalt be no more. Though thou be sought for, yet shalt thou never be found again, saith the Adonai Yahweh.
Yeah, you know, Tyre was a really great city, and it was famed throughout the entire world at the time.
Sounds like
and
it.
Colonies from Tyre went from Palestine to Cyprus to Thessaly in Greece to Carthage in Africa, the islands all around Italy, places in Italy, the river valleys in Gaul. Miletus in Anatolia was originally a colony of Phoenicians, and Iberia and Britain. So Tyre was certainly famed throughout the world at the time. Yet, there's hardly a mention of the fall of the mainland city in historical records. In fact, I don't think there is one. And that is probably because of the fact that the early poets of the Greek writers were focused on the legend surrounding Troy. And Tyre did not begin its ascent to predominance until shortly after or right around the Trojan period. And in fact, the Trojan War probably began right around 1200 BC. And the building of Tyre, the island city, which really became famous, according to Josephus, happened 240 years before the temple was built.
Okay.
And that would be, if the temple was built in 980 BC, that would only be 20 years before the Trojan War. So the poets, especially Homer, writing about the Trojan War period, certainly wouldn't really have a need to mention this new upstart city that was just being built. And in fact, it's possible that they thought that perhaps it wasn't yet built until after the Trojan War. It puts the story together for me when I see that Homer doesn't mention Tyre in the context of the Trojan War, but he does mention Sidon. But by the time the Greek historians started writing, which wasn't really until the time, the earliest linear historian we know is Hecataeus of Abdera, and his history writing does not survive. It's lost to us. We only have a couple of fragments. So the first linear historian we have is Herodotus, and he didn't write until 450 BC. And that was 150 years after Tyre was destroyed. So what he wrote about Tyrians, knowing them from history, and he wrote plenty about Phoenicians, but he wrote very little about Tyre itself as a city, you know, the mainland city in its glory years. That's just not the purpose of Herodotus' work. He does write of the island city, how they built ships for the that they built a lot of ships for the Persians and contributed their men and their maritime skills to the Persian army, but that didn't save them. That they were, every ship they built was destroyed in the war against the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
Now the amazing thing about this prophecy, it's written by Ezekiel, and it's written in 587 BC. Now Tyre was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, but only the mainland city was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. The island city was not, okay? Nebuchadnezzar just simply didn't have the maritime ability and the skills to take down the island city, and rather they cut a deal with them and they kept their city. Now the mainland city was completely destroyed, and it was never, ever rebuilt, just like Yahweh says it was never rebuilt. When Alexander the Great comes through 250 years later, the rubble of Tyre on the mainland is still sitting there. He seeks to hold a siege against the island city, which is not bending to his will. He takes the rubble and uses it to fill in a bridge to the island city, He makes a huge causeway from the mainland to the island with the rubble of the ancient city that was never cleaned up, that was never rebuilt for 250 years. That's how perfect the word of Yahweh is. And when Alexander destroyed the island city, it was indeed scraped clean like the top of a rock. Today it exists below the surface of the Mediterranean.
That's really incredible. Now, where is that information on using the rubble to build a causeway?
Well, I read it in history books.
I
don't have the citations on the top of my head. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I just, because that's really like you said, when Yahweh makes a prophecy, it's doesn't just come true, but comes true in minute areas of perfection that, I mean, his word is just so perfect that makes perfect sense that would take place like that, you know. Just like when Yahshua said, not one stone will be left upon another. And no, history records that the Romans tore the stones apart to get the melted gold out. So it's just interesting. I hadn't heard that one before.
Well, here we see that Yahweh said this city would never be rebuilt. It was the greatest city of antiquity, and it wasn't rebuilt.
Yeah, but I was just really thinking here on this part of the prophecy where it says, I'm going to make you like the top of a rock where they spread the nets. And you would just, you know, they wouldn't be spreading the nets over rubble. You'd want to spread the nets over a smoothed out area, you know.
Well, it seems to me like Alexander probably smoothed it out, right?
Absolutely.
He took all the rubble and had it carried into the sea. It seems to me like that probably would have smoothed it out.
Yeah, no doubt about it. That's where I was going with it. It makes perfect sense. You know, let's get that rubble out of here if we're going to spread the nets out and fix them, you know.
Now, Ezekiel 27 is a lamentation of Tyre, the entire chapter. And,
mm-hmm.
and 28 is a lamentation of the prince of Tyre. But 27 shows also that Tyre was certainly an Israelite city. At 27:6, we're going to see that the Asherites of 27:6 are the tribe of Asher. They're not
mm-hmm.
the Assyrians, Asher. It's misspelled there in the King James. They're two distinct Hebrew words, and here we have the word for the tribe of the Israelite tribe of Asher, even though it's not spelled with the traditional E. And they, Ezekiel 27:6, puts them in Cyprus, which is Kittim here. And that's an island of famous Phoenician colonies, which was subject to Tyre, according to Josephus, before the Assyrian conquest. Antiquities 9, chapter 14. So we see that Cyprus was really subject to Israelites. At Ezekiel 27:12 here, we see that the tribes of Dan had to be the Danan Greeks, and Javan, who are the Japhethite Ionian Greeks, brought trade to Tyre. And that's the only way Dan and Javan would be mentioned together, is if Dan were the Danan Greeks, and we know from history that Javan are the Ionian Greeks. Now the Septuagint adds a line to 27:18, which is not found in the AV, which reads, and wool from Miletus, and they brought wine into thy market. Miletus was also an ancient Carian Phoenician settlement in southwest Anatolia. And while the government of the city had at some point become Ionian, the general character of the population and the wider province was always heavily Phoenician. Thales of Miletus was the city's most famous resident, and he was an early famous quote-unquote Greek philosopher who Herodotus explicitly said was a Phoenician by race. And we'll Ezekiel 27 is a complete connection of the ancient Israelites, the northern tribes, to the entire Greek world and the entire Mesopotamian world. The Jews like us to believe that somehow these Israelites existed in a vacuum, and that way they could write their history. If Christians read the prophets, that they would see that none of what the Jews say about the Canaanites, about the Phoenicians, or about the ancient Hebrews could possibly be true.
No, they've just dumbed everybody down so much that nobody digs in and really studies it anymore. They just, you know, if someone in authority says it, that's good enough. And of course, you know, they've conquered academia, and so whatever they teach there is essentially unchallenged. I mean, who's going to challenge, you know, the major universities? So, and of course, they control the textbooks, so they can really control the flow of what's being taught. So it's no wonder, you know, we've, you know, been dumbed down to where we don't even understand our historical past, even though it's kind of right in front of us with the little work. It's not a surprise.
Would you like to read 27. Ezekiel 27. Yes. I'm going to be interrupting you a lot here because I have a lot of historical notes identifying these places and these people.
I just jump in. The word of Yahweh came again unto me, saying, "Now, thou son of man, take up a lamentation for Tyrus, and say unto Tyrus, O thou that art situate at the entry of the sea, which art a merchant for the people, or which art a merchant of the people for many isles. Thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, O Tyrus, thou hast said, I am of perfect beauty. Thy borders are in the midst of the seas. Thy builders have perfected thy beauty. They have made all thy ship boards of fir trees, of Sinir.
Sinir is a town of Manasseh, which is east of the Jordan. It's 1 Chronicles 5:23, and here we see Manasseh involved in the Phoenician maritime industry.
Okay. They have taken cedars from Lebanon to make masts for thee. Of the oaks of Bashan have they made thine oars. The company of the Asherites have made thy benches of ivory, brought out of the isles of Chittim.
Now, Bashan is the land, basically, of Reuben. It's north of the plains of Moab on the other side of the Jordan, and it's Israelite territory. Now, the tribe of Asher is the company of the Asherites, and the KJV spelling is very misleading here, but it's clearly the Israelite tribe of Asher, both in the Septuagint and in Hebrew, and they are involved, that they have made thy benches of ivory. The Asherites were building ships. They were the Phoenicians. They weren't Jews sitting in a synagogue while these Canaanite Phoenicians were building ships.
Sure.
Okay. The Asherites are the Phoenicians, and they are building the ships. And they are procuring the wood from the oaks for the oars from the tribe of Reuben. And they're procuring the planks for the sides of the ships from the tribe of Manasseh. We have Israel building ships here. That's what's being described. And Asher's doing it in Cyprus, which is Kittim. Kittim was actually the name of the Japhethite tribe, and early Cyprus was named for it, and it's the Japhethites that clearly originally inhabited all of the islands of the Mediterranean. We could put Japhethites on them in history. However, the Cyprus or Kittim later became the home of many ancient Phoenician colonies, and it was a great stepping stone of our people from Palestine into the maritime world and into Europe.
Mm-hmm. Should I start back at verse 7 here?
Yes.
Okay. Fine linen with broidered work from Egypt was that which thou spreadest forth to be thy sail. Blue and purple from the isles of Elishah was that which covered thee. The inhabitants of Zidon and Arvad were thy mariners. Thy wise men, O Tyrus, that were in thee were thy pilots. The ancients of Gebal and the wise men thereof were in thee thy caulkers. All the ships of the sea with their mariners were in thee to occupy thy merchandise.
Now this Elisha, the location of Elisha is often debated, right? It's hard to pin down. And Elisha is also a son of Javan. So we see that the people of Elisha must be related to the Ionian Greeks and the Japhethites, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, some scholars put Elisha on a portion of Cyprus along with Kittim, and they Elisha and Kittim were brothers. They're portrayed as being brothers in Genesis chapter 10, verse 4, the descendants of Noah. Okay? So that, to me, is the most plausible explanation, that a portion of Cyprus was Elisha. But others claim that Elisha was somewhere on the coast of northern Syria. But either way, it's just really a guess, right? Now, chapter 8, the inhabitants of Sidon, as we see in Scripture, was an area which is dominated by Israelites, but Canaanites also dwelt there. Now, and remained, even though they were enslaved throughout the kingdom period. Now, Arvad is an island off the coast of modern-day Syria. It's very close to Sidon, and it's mentioned in inscriptions, including an inscription of a list of tributaries left by the Assyrian king Ashur-nasir-pal, who ruled Assyria from circa 883 to 859 BC, and that's 120 years before the Assyrians invaded Israel proper, but they already had, and it's really not discussed in the Bible, but they already had Sidon and Arvad under tribute at that early time. We don't really see it recorded in the Bible until the Assyrian encroachment, until they encroach on Samaria itself.
Okay.
Now let me Gebal is the Gebal, the ancients of Gebal. Gebal is the Hebrew name for Byblos, and that was a famous Phoenician city on the coast of Syria, and
okay.
I believe that was one of the first Israelite colonies. Oh, okay, go on.
Okay, let's see, verse 10. They of Persia and of Lud and of Phut were in thine army. Thy men of war, they hanged the shield and helmet in thee. They set forth thy comeliness. The men of Arvad with thine army were upon thy walls round about, and the Gamadens were in thy towers. They hanged their shields upon the walls round about. They have made thy beauty perfect.
Now this, Gamadens only means warriors. I don't know why the King James didn't translate it. I guess they thought it was a reference to a name, but it's only a Hebrew word that means warriors. The warriors were in thy towers, or their warriors were in thy towers. Now we see the men of Arvad mentioned again from the island off the coast of Sidon, right?
Yeah.
Now the they of Persia and Lud and Phut. Okay, there's two Luds, and there's a Lud mentioned in Isaiah in Genesis 10. That's a descendant of Shem, and that's the Lud in Lydia, which is in western Anatolia, and that is almost surely not this Lud. This Lud is mentioned along with Phut, and Phut is a Hamitic tribe, and I'm sure this Lud is also the Lud of Ham, and they're mentioned with Persia, but you know not all of the Hamites went to Africa, because the first Babylonian empire was actually an empire of Cush, who was a descendant of Ham. If this Lud was in Africa, I would surely bet that it was probably the Indian Ocean side, where we see a great trade of Solomon and Hiram going to Ophir, which is the name that we get from the name that we get Africa from is Ophir. Mentioned
mm-hmm.
in Genesis chapter 10 and in the exploits of Hiram and Solomon. Now this that there is a Put or a Putu Yamani, which is described in a Babylonian inscription, okay, which is described as an island off the coast near Egypt. And that Putu might be related to this Phut, okay?
Okay.
It's possible that maybe these tribes did inhabit part of Egypt east of what we consider, west of what we consider Egypt proper, which is really only, Egypt to the ancients was really only the Nile River Valley, and that was it.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that it's plausible that this Putu, which is an island off the coast of Egypt, as described in Babylonian inscriptions, okay? And it's mentioned, I'm referring to ancient Near Eastern text related to the Old Testament, page 308, published at Princeton University in 1969. That's the book I'm referring to, with this Babylonian inscription that talks about this Putu being an island off the coast near Egypt. And that might be ancient Put, okay, or Phut. P-U-T and P-H-U-T are basically the same word in Hebrew. But the, yeah, you know, there are no islands off the coast of Egypt today. However, there is one mentioned in this inscription. Now, it's demonstrable from both history and archaeology that the coast of Egypt is very different today than it was in ancient times. And that's due to combinations of earthquakes and a rise in the sea level. Yeah, you know, for 10 centuries, European scholars scoffed at Herodotus, who said that that there were certain cities on the Mediterranean coast of Egypt that had never been found until recently, when they were found far under the sea. They were actually found off the coast of Egypt under the sea. And nobody laughs at Herodotus about that anymore.
Yeah. See, where'd I leave off? I think it was verse...
I'm sorry, you're at verse...
verse 11.
12.
Oh, verse 12, okay, sorry. Tarshish was thy merchant by reason of the multitude of all kind of riches, with silver, iron, tin, and lead. They traded in thy fairs. Jabon, Tubal, and Meshach, they were thy merchants. They traded the persons of men and vessels of brass in thy market. They of the house of Togarma traded in thy fairs with horses and horsemen and mules.
Well, let me go. I got a ton of notes here, too. It's got to be gone through, right? Now, Tarshish, this is very important. Tarshish was thy merchant by reason of the multitude of all kinds of riches, silver, iron, tin, and lead, right? Tarshish was a district in what is now southern Spain. And the Jews hate to talk about the ships of Tarshish. And they hate to talk about it because if you examine the ships of Tarshish, you'll find Iberia or Hebrew land at the other end. And none of those people were Jews. And that's why the Jews fought for so many centuries to destroy Spain and tried like hell even until the Spanish Civil War, right? And they, for the most part, I'm afraid they have. Tarshish was the Tartessus of the ancient Greek writers, and Tartessus was in southern Spain. And this account here is highly consistent with the mention of the tin trade and the accounts of the tin trade, which ran from Britain through from what we know as Cornwall today, right? Through Spain and through Gaul and on to the East and the Mediterranean and the Levant. And this tin trade is talked about by all the ancient historians. Herodotus tells us that Tarshish did not grow in fame as a trading town until after the Trojan War. And that is consistent with Scripture, and it's fully consistent with the stories. In fact, it's almost perfectly consistent with the stories of the ships of Hiram and Solomon, that because that would have happened not 150, 200 years after the Persian War. Now, Javan, verse 13, they are the Ionian Greeks. We know that from history very clearly, where the Behistun Rock talks about things that the Ionian Greeks did and calls them Yavanna. Tubal and Meshech, verse 13. These tribes were once settled on the southeast coast of the Black Sea near the Caucasus Mountains. They're mentioned by Herodotus as Maski and Tabarni. That's the Hellenized versions of Tubal, of what we see in the Masoretic text is Tubal and Meshech. Now, apparently these people were eventually pushed north by the Scythians, and these people are among the East Slavs of today. And they evidently give us the names Moscow and Tobolsk.
Right.
Togarma, verse 14, Togarma is the Japhethite son of Gomer. Since the ancient horse trade, by all accounts, seems to have come from Asia, where the best and largest horses are found, which is beyond the Caspian Sea. It seems to me that this is the most likely dwelling place of Togarma and the sons of Gomer. around the Caspian Sea.
Bill, what do you think were the racial origins of Tubal and Meshach?
Well,
they were
Hethites. They were clearly white.
Okay.
And today, a lot of them are still white, but they have a huge strain of Mongol blood in them from the Mongol invasions.
Because, I mean, were not some of these people eventually mixed in with some of the Khazarian peoples? Did they not get in that general vicinity?
Well, I believe that the Khazars were originally white. But, yes, the Khazars and the Jews, who the Khazars had adopted their religion and intermingled with them, they also mixed in with all of the East Slavs. There's no doubt. And a lot of the West Slavs. The Poles and the Slavs of the Balkans. There's no doubt.
Okay. Because these names ring a bell, and I know that geography, as soon as you mentioned down in that area around the Caspian and Black Sea, I mean, that became Khazaria. And, so if these people settled there, then, eventually, I guess they would have probably mixed with these Jews then around 700 or 800 A.D., approximately.
Well, the Khazar Jewish Turkish trading empire, which was one third white, one third Edomite, and one third Mongol, right? Basically, and I don't know how the populations were balanced, but as soon as the Khazars, the white Khazars, admitted to Judaism, that left their women open to be looted and pillaged by the Edomite Jews.
Right.
And you could bet that, a lot of people might think, oh, the Khazars, that they weren't Jews. Well, you could bet that I would certainly be confident that just about every Khazar somewhere over the last 800, 900, 1,000 years intermarried with somebody of the Edomite stock.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because the Edomites were virtually, from the time of Theodosius, forced out of the civil life of the Eastern Byzantine Empire. And they found refuge in the Khazar Empire.
Yeah.
In large numbers.
And they've always had a history of mixing with whatever race was available to them.
Well yes, I believe that Khazar Empire probably consisted of both Scythian Israelite, a remnant of Scythian Israel that never migrated west, along with many of the Persian and Assyrian, Shemitic, and Japhethite tribes. I don't see it as one single racial tribal entity that many see it. Now, they had also the Mongols to the east and the Uyghurs, U-I-G-H-U-R-S. There's various pronunciations of that word. I like to call them Uyghurs, but it's probably Uyghurs or Uyghurs or something like that.
I thought you said Uyghur. I'm trying to think. Yeah, they had Uyghurs back then.
Well, we certainly
have them now,
These people migrated out of what we know today as China, and the further west they got, the whiter they became until that they eventually became what we know today as Turks. And the Turks are part Uyghur, part Turk, part Jew, part Hittite, part Celt, part Greek. The Turks are the most racially mixed people probably in the world.
Yeah.
Next to the Jews.
They can look like just about anything.
Well, yes, they can. It's incredible how many races have crossed through there. Yet you got the Mongols controlled that period. Yet, in the Middle Ages, several tribes of Mongols control all the way down to Egypt, and Clifton's been writing about that lately, and he's written about it before.
But it's just interesting to realize that studying the history of the people we call Jews is really just a history of how they've race mixed with various peoples throughout history. They've really almost never, from the very beginning, had any concept of a racial purity.
Well, absolutely. But when Ezekiel is writing this prophecy, all of these people are white except the Canaanites and the Hittites and the other descendants of Cain and the Edomites, and we know who they are. Yeah, you know, there were mixed race nations at this time. The Moabites were, and the Ammonites, that they were part Israelites living in Moab, part Moabites. The Moabites were white, but they had intermarried with the Canaanites. Ammonites were white, but they had intermarried with the Canaanites, and they both intermarried with the Amorites. And it's, yeah, you know, there were nations at this time that were mixed, but the Bible tells us who they are.
Well, it makes perfect sense because, I mean, the very origin of the Jew was in a race-mixing situation in the garden. So why would race-mixing not just be the way that they propagate throughout the generations?
Well, absolutely. And when we get to Ezekiel, I think it might be Ezekiel 37, we'll see that this is the garden of Yahweh. However, most of these tribes are absolutely white at this time, 600 BC.
Yeah. I just find it fascinating that race mixing brings destruction to our race, but to the Jew, it just allows them to survive. It passes on their genetic strains.
Well, that's the vampire story. I mean,
yeah, it really is, and it will bring an end to us, but it will continue their existence across the centuries. It's really quite interesting to see it from that point of view, and I'm appreciating the history lesson here.
Look at what those nations were. Look at what Egypt was, the greatest of all nations at its height until about the 8th century B.C. Assyria was the greatest of all nations at its height. Babylon, the wonders of Babylon, the hanging gardens, the fact that the city walls were built right over the river Euphrates, that the city straddled this huge, mighty river at this ancient time, that these people could build city walls. And city walls, I'm not talking about a little six-foot wall like you got in your backyard. Herodotus said that the walls of Babylon were 200 feet tall, and that's probably that might be an exaggeration. However, they were huge, huge walls, and they were thick. They were 20, 30 feet thick. That there were several chariots could cross and pass each other on the ramparts at the top of these walls. That they were huge, and they were that they traversed the river Euphrates. They went over the river to the other side. And that must have been a sight to see. And these, what happened to this wonderful architectural ability, to this amazing engineering ability that we see in ancient Egypt, in ancient Assyria, in ancient Persia, when the white blood went, now these cities crumble to dust. When Cairo suffered an earthquake in the 9th century A.D., the Egyptians of the time, who were really Arabs, and they were Mongols and Arabs, they went and they burnt fires on the Great Pyramid to break up the rocks so they could have the stone to rebuild their city. But they couldn't quarry their own damn stone.
Yeah. It's just like it is today. You know, you look at our great cities crumbling and disintegrating.
It's exactly like it is today. As we race mix, our structures and edifices and buildings, our wonderful, marvelous cities decay into dust. Why is Egypt, Iraq, Mesopotamia, Iran, all of those countries are no good for anything except for the last 200 years, except a graveyard for Western archaeologists to dig through, and a war zone to fight over some oil in the ground. That's it.
That's it.
Those people would have nothing if it weren't for the oil money that we're stupid enough to give to them. We should have just went and taken their damned oil, which was the English idea in the first place. What would they have? What have they built? Nothing. In 2,000 years. Why? Because they are a Mamzer. They are a mongrel people. Mongrel people accomplish nothing. Ever. Anywhere in history, mongrelized nations have gone down the dustbin.
Yep. Pretty much that's exactly it.
Look at Sicily. Sicily and southern Italy are an economic basket case. Look at Greece today. It's half Turk. It's an economic basket case. Look at Spain. Today, America is becoming the same way. Why? Because we're becoming a mixed race nation, and because the dark races are starting to outnumber the white race.
There's no denying that, Bill. And we're just seeing ourselves slide down that same slope.
But, well, right. We're the next Babylon. That's why we're Mystery Babylon in the Bible. That's why we're the whore. Our race is the whore, the great whore in Revelation 18. Let's finish this chapter.
Okay.
Well, we're at, I don't know where we are. Well, we're at verse 15.
Let's see, I read 15. We're at 16. Well, I'll start at 15. The men of Dedan were thy merchants. Many isles were the merchandise of thine hand. They brought thee for a present horns of ivory and ebony.
Now notice who the merchants were, right? The men of Dedan are Ishmaelites and Edomites. Dedan was a mixed Ishmael-Edomite city far to the south in Arabia. Dedan was a town on the east of the Red Sea on the caravan routes, which ran, and it sat on the caravan routes, and it ran from the east of the Red Sea down south to the ports of Sheba and east to Babylonia and north through Moab to Bashan. Dedan was at the crossroads of the caravan routes that traversed the Arabian desert.
Okay. Let's see. Verse 16. Syria was thy merchant by reason of the multitude of the wares of thy making. They occupied in thy fairs with emeralds, purple embroidered work, and fine linen, and coral, and agate.
Now, this Syria is a poor translation, and I wish they'd never done this. Everywhere they saw the word Aram, they translated it Syria. And we get the wrong idea of Syria in our heads because, you know, Aram was really only the city around Damascus, and then the land of Paddan Aram far to the north in what's today northern Syria.
Okay.
And the Chaldees of Babylon were also descended from Aram, but they had long since split from the people of Damascus.
Okay. Verse 17, Judah and the land of Israel, they were thy merchants. They traded in thy market wheat of Minnith and
Minnith is actually a city in Ammon, which the Israelites had taken in the days from the Ammonites in the days of Jephthah, and that's in Judges chapter 11.
Okay. And honey and oil and balm. Damascus was thy merchant in the multitude of the wares of thy making. For the multitude of all riches in the wine of Helbon and white wool. Dan also and Jabon going to and fro, occupied in thy fairs. Bright iron, cassia, and calamus were in thy market.
Now this must be the Dan in Greeks, Dan. And the Ionian Greeks, Javan. And that's the only way these two tribes should be mentioned together.
Okay. Dedan was thy merchant in precious clothes for chariots. Arabia and all the princes of Kedar, they occupied with thee in lambs and rams and goats. In these were they thy merchants. The merchants of Sheba and Ramah, they were thy merchants. They occupied in thy fairs with chief of all spices and with all precious stones and gold, Haran and Cania and Eden, the merchants of Sheba, Asher, and Chilmad were thy merchants.
Now, some of these places are pretty obscure, right?
Yeah.
Chilmad, I don't know if we'll ever know where that is. Sheba is probably, there's been an ancient habitation which seems to have been of kingdom size uncovered in the mountains of southern Yemen that's often identified as Sheba, and that seems to make sense, the queen of the south, the queen of Sheba. That there's Haran is the ancestral town of Abraham in far northern Syria, where we find Padan Aram, the place from which both Isaac and Jacob obtained their wives. And Cana is totally obscure, but Eden is also a general Akkadian word for the steppe or the grasslands to the north.
All right. Let's see, verse 24. These were thy merchants in all sorts of things, in blue clothes and embroidered work, and in chests of rich apparel, bound with cords and made of cedar, among thy merchandise. The ships of Tarshish did sing of thee in thy market, and thou wast replenished and made very glorious in the midst of the seas. The rowers have brought thee into great waters. The east wind hath broken thee in the midst of the seas. Thy riches and thy fares, thy merchandise, thy mariners and thy pilots, thy caulkers and the occupiers of thy merchandise, and all thy men of war that are in thee, and in all thy company which is in the midst of thee, shall fall to the midst of the seas in the day of thy ruin. The suburbs shall shake at the sound of the cry of thy pilots, and all that handle the oar, the mariners, and all the pilots of the sea shall come down from their ships. They shall stand upon the land, and shall cause their voice to be heard against thee, and shall cry bitterly, and shall cast up dust upon their head. They shall wallow themselves in the ashes, and they shall make themselves utterly bald for thee, and gird them with sackcloth, and they shall weep for thee with bitterness of heart and bitter wailing.
Now this language is absolutely identical to the language of Revelation chapter 18 and the vision of the future fall of Babylon, which is the global trade system that we also see here in the old world. History indeed repeats itself. Well, whenever we engage as a people in global trade, we forget who we are, we forget our purpose, we fall to the desires of Satan, the globalist mercantile Jew. There's no doubt.
Yeah. Certainly the Jew absolutely runs the global mercantile system. You can imagine every worldwide shipping company is just Jews top to bottom. Probably
all the Canaanites, the Edomites, they controlled this global system of trade then, just like they controlled the budding and the growth of the English Empire the same way. It may have been a wonderful thing for the English people to spread out throughout the world and establish wonderful nations in the Americas, in Australia, well, that was a prison colony, in Canada, and in various other places, and often to our detriment, right? In India, that wasn't good, and
yeah,
the African colonies didn't work out good. But anyway, that was when you study the growth of that empire, it was the Edomite Jew in London who was behind it.
Oh, yeah. Who else would have the money to finance such a thing? You know, not much has changed. Let's see, verse 32. And in their wailing, they shall take up a lamentation for thee and lament over thee, saying, what city is like Tyrus, like the destroyed in the midst of the sea? When thy wares went forth out of the seas, thou filledst many people. Thou didst enrich the kings of the earth with the multitude of thy riches and of thy merchandise. In the time when thou shalt be broken by the seas and the depths of the waters, thy merchandise and all thy company in the midst of thee shall fall. All the inhabitants of the isle shall be astonished at thee, and their kings shall be sore afraid, and they shall be troubled in their countenance. The merchants among the people shall hiss at thee. Thou shalt be a terror, and never shalt be any more. Yeah, you're right. It's pretty much exactly like Revelation 18. A lot of parallels.
This is exactly Revelation chapter 18 all over again. And that's because history repeats itself. And we establish these wonderful nations, and when the Edomite Jew catches up to us, we keep letting him infiltrate our nation in the name of commerce and money. And before you know it, he's taken it over, and we have a porno industry and a gambling industry and all of these other perversions that we didn't have before he got here, or that we had, but they were virtually out of sight in back rooms, in private houses, and we never saw them. Or they were hard to see, let's put it that way. We have sin, but when we have the Jew, we have absolute open profligacy, and we have a total breakdown in morals.
We have Satan run amok among us.
Well, we have it now. We see it now.
We see it now.
The, And yeah, you know, this was a very moral country. We had our share of sin, but it was a very moral country until the 1880s, 1890s. We let the Jew in great numbers, and the Jew set up all his little gods. And once the Jew set up all his little gods and dragged our people away, well, we've gone straight down that same path that so many empires had before us, and we're going straight to hell.
Yeah. It's a hard situation we find ourselves in, no question. And the Jew today probably has more money now than they've ever had, now that they have the ability to just invent it from thin air. Who knows what colossal reservoirs of wealth they're sitting on. Hard to put a number on it. Just short of infinity. A lot. Anything they want, they can buy at this point. They can control. So they've got their tentacles in deeper than at any time in history, I would think, right now.
Well, absolutely. It's gotten worse every time. There's no doubt. There's nowhere to go now. I mean, back then, our people could go to Britain. That they could go travel up the Danube River and migrate into Germany. That they could leave the Levant and go to Carthage and go on to Ireland and get away from the Canaanite Jew, from the Edomite Jew for the most part. Today, there's nowhere to go. It's got to end here. We have to draw the line here.
And it almost makes sense, doesn't it, Bill, that they would think at this point, finally, we control this world, so let's take it to the next step and really control this world. Make it our own. I mean, to the point where, you know, in a sense, we've outlived our usefulness, so they would think. I don't know. It seems like some rough times coming up here, not just for us, but for this world and certainly for these Edomites.
Well, I don't see how we could have a much rougher time than we had in the 30 Years' War, than we had in the Napoleonic Wars. Than we've had in the American, well, I don't really want to call it a civil war, the Rothschild's war on America in 1860, we had in World War I, World War II, the so-called Great Depression. We're going to get more of that, but I don't really know how we could have it harder than any of those. I mean, that was, well, we've had rough times, and that's what a lot of people miss, is that we have been in a period of tribulation for over 2,500 years.
I see it that way as well. And in the last 100 years alone, the tribulation against our race, especially over in Europe and Eastern Europe with the purges over there of the Jews. I mean, if that wasn't great tribulation, then I don't know what great tribulation is. That was incredible tribulation. Tens of millions of our kin slaughtered.
Well, no doubt. It's our duty to point out the sin and to point out who's responsible for it. Because the enemies of our God have been behind it every step of the way.
Yeah. And we see from these prophecies that Yahweh was dealing with it then. He's going to deal with it now, and there's going to be a final dealing with it. You know, whenever that's going to be, that's going to be. But there will be that final day of judgment for them that will deal
absolutely.
With it.
That's the Christian hope. Well, without that hope, we have no hope, because our race is the most pitiful race in history.
And we're not able at this point to rise up and overcome these creatures at this point. I don't see that as a possibility.
Well, most of us
on our own.
Off our couch without a bag of chips in our hand, and that's only to go to the refrigerator for a beer.
Well, you have an eloquent way of putting it, but I can't disagree. We need Yahweh. We need His mercy, and we'll have it. There's many instances in the scriptures and in the Apocrypha that talk about when things look really dark for us at the end. Yahweh is just going to strengthen His right arm and bring about the judgment of the Jew and the Edomite and rescue His elect, whether we deserve it or not. So, I'm encouraged by that. Even though we live in discouraging times currently, but there's a lot to be encouraged about.
Well, we have a Christian hope, and with this much of biblical prophecy clearly having come true at all throughout our history, and it's totally evident if anybody would study it and study history, that there's no mistaking it. with this much of biblical prophecy having come true, the word of God has to be completely true, and the Christian hope shall be fulfilled. There's no doubt.
Amen. There's tons of historical precedent that Yahweh, when there was prophecy, Yahweh fulfilled it to perfection and fulfilled his word. And there's no reason to think the rest of it will not be fulfilled as well. I have no doubt whatsoever. None. The only thing is just a matter of when it's going to take place and what we do in the meantime. So.
Okay, Greg, thanks for joining me tonight.
Yeah, thanks for the invite. I enjoyed it. And praise Yahweh.
Yes, praise Yahweh. Good night.
Good night, Bill.